And now the moment you've all been waiting for, as they say, except we have someone else to talk before the moment you've been waiting for, seriously. We're fortunate that Mr. Alan Horton, past president of Forum Club, got a speaker for us for today, and Alan has been very good at bringing in speakers for the Forum Club, and I think we're probably going to have another home run today. And I'd like to reintroduce Alan Horton to you, and he will introduce today's speaker. Thank you. Alan?
Thank you, Dave, very much. Well, today we have a West Virginia native. I can't remember the last time we had a West Virginian speaking from this podium. He's a Princeton grad. I'm glad one of the students is interested in going to Princeton for his sake. He was very happy to hear that. He's the author of three books. He's a prize-winning cartoonist. He was in Washington in the Scripps Bureau in Washington as the cartoonist during the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton years. And in the last decade or a little more, he's been the cartoonist for the Detroit News. He also is founder and editor of the MichiganView.com, which is a phenomenal website about everything of any interest in Michigan, with some of the best writers and best thinkers in the state. He has this strange view that Michigan can be fixed. And even more impossible that it is being fixed. And I think he might talk about that. He's written for the National Review, the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, Reason Magazine. His cartoons are syndicated in papers from San Francisco to New York. He's been in USA Today frequently, the Washington Times. And I want to just tell a couple of anecdotes. I've known Henry Payne, our speaker, for a number of years. In fact, he worked for the organization that I headed. And he was... let me read the review that his last editor wrote about him before he left Scripps and went to Detroit. It's pretty amazing, actually. And if I can find it, I'll tell you what. Well, I'm going to have to paraphrase it because I can't find it, and I don't want to waste your time. Oh, here it is. It's a simple little two-sentence review. Considering that he is a cartoonist, I was surprised that he is such a good reporter and an elegant writer. He is conservative, but not ideological or rigid in his beliefs. He understands business and marketed and sold his own cartoons for years. He easily could be an editor of a newspaper or a magazine or a website. And, of course, he is. it was prescient. The other thing, I'll tell you one anecdote that Henry won't remember, but I want to try to knock him off his feet a little bit before he starts. He donated a cartoon of Washington's then mayor, Marion Barry. You might remember Marion Barry, to a charity auction called Cartoons and Cocktails. Henry wasn't able to stay at the auction, but he instructed the office manager of the Scripps Washington Bureau, Lori Hackett, to go enjoy a few drinks and make a bid or two on his cartoon to drive up the price for charity. It should go for about $1,000, Henry told Lori. Well, Lori enjoyed the three drinks and did as instructed, raising her hand occasionally. And finally, the auctioneer said, going, twice to the lady in the red sweater and pointed. Well, she wasn't in a position, but she had to write the check. And well, Henry was very nice about it. He didn't reimburse her, but he did write a little note to her that says, the tune that put a hole in your wallet. Anyway, I've got a lot of stories which I won't tell because I don't want to steal his time. But please help me welcome Henry Payne.
Thanks, Alan. That was nice. Lori clearly had a few too many drinks that night, paying $1,000 for one of my cartoons. That's off. You can hear me okay on this? Yes? Everybody hear me all right? Alan's been thanking me since I flew in last night for coming down on short notice to speak with you. And I said to Alan, I said, no, Alan, thank you. I mean, coming down to Florida in December from Detroit is a, it's a, That's a wonderful thing. So it's great to be down here with all of you in warm Naples in December. In addition to that nice introduction from Alan, I want to tell you a couple other things about me that are relevant. I'm this weird hybrid journalist. I'm the editorial cartoonist for the Detroit News. I'm a writer for the Wall Street Journal and National Review. I'm the editor and founder of the MichiganView.com publication up in Michigan. And I love my business. I love journalism. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. But I'm also a former collegiate basketball player, and I am a board member on my family's electrical manufacturing company. And what I've learned in those endeavors, what I learned early on in those endeavors in manufacturing and in athletics, is that unless you do the fundamentals well, you don't succeed. And the same is true for public policy. If you don't do the fundamentals right, then you don't succeed. You get into trouble. And I'm going to talk to you today about a lot of things, about media, about Michigan, about the election, the forthcoming election here in 2012. But underlying all of this is fundamentals. If we don't get the fundamentals right in public policy and politics, then things go wrong. Let me start with some good news about the American media. And I met Bill Hoagland last night. And Bill's a Detroiter, a great former executive with GM, and we were laughing over dinner. And I said to Bill, I said, "What media do you read? Where do you get your information?" And Bill said, "I don't. I don't like the media." And I love that. I love that comment. Because it reminded me of my father. My father was a genius businessman, and we would talk around the table when I was growing up. And my father would have rather gone in and gotten his wisdom teeth out at the dentist than take a call from a journalist. But journalism is essential to a democracy. The information that we get is essential to how informed we are and to make informed decisions. And today, in the media, this is a golden era. I mean, this is the third great revolution going on in American journalism. The first being the penny press in the early 19th century, the introduction of the drum press, which made newspapers a mass product. You had the TV revolution in the mid-20th century, and today you have the internet and cable revolution. And it's a marvelous time, not only for me to be producing products in journalism, but I think it's a great time for this country because never have the fundamentals of media been better. Because there are more media, there are more resources, there are more ways to get news, and there are more ways than ever for the citizens of this country to be informed, and that should not be underestimated. As much as we complain about media, this is really a good time for our profession and for its readers. And to give you some perspective on that, let me take you back 15 years to the 1996 convention. As part of my weird hybrid journalism thing, I'm going to talk to you and illustrate my lecture with some of my own cartoons. But in 1996 was a very different media time. It was just 15 years ago. I was at the 1996 Chicago Democratic Convention. The Clinton-Gore ticket was up for re-election. It was a very similar time today politically. Republicans had come in force in 1994 in reaction to Clinton's attempt to nationalize health care. There had been a tremendous reaction against that. The Clinton-Gore camp were on their heels, and as they revved up for the 1996 presidential election, they were taking a very similar tack to what the Obama-Biden ticket is doing today. They went into attack mode. They and they tried to set the country against certain select corporations. Today, it's Big Oil and Wall Street. In 1996, it was Big Tobacco. And Al Gore, I was tasked with giving a key speech at the 1996 convention in order to talk about the evils of Big Tobacco. And it was a very emotional, very dramatic speech because it centered around his sister. And his sister, some of you may recall, had died of lung cancer. She was a lifetime smoker. And the convention hall got very quiet. And Gore told this emotional story about sitting next to his sister as she died from lung cancer. And Gore said, "And I vowed at that moment that I would not let Big Tobacco get away with this. That I would dedicate my life to fighting Big Tobacco and the scourge of smoking." And the reaction of the press, this was a time when the press was dominated by the big three networks. This is pre-cable. This is pre-internet. There was no Drudge Report. Fox and Drudge were both created actually later that year, in the fall of 1996. This was a mainstream media dominated media in 1996, and the reaction to Gore's speech was rapturous. This was a major speech. This was a seminal speech. It was emotional. He had personalized the issue, and I was sitting on the convention floor and listening to this reaction. And as a Scripps guy, we had a property in Tennessee, and I knew quite a bit about Al Gore, and I knew that everything that Al Gore had just said on national television was a fib. In fact, Al Gore continued after 1984, well into the early 90s, to take thousands of dollars from the tobacco industry. This was a Tennessee senator, after all. More than that, he continued to grow tobacco on his own property in Tennessee. And in 1988, which was Gore's first presidential run, he bragged to a meeting of donors saying that he had grown tobacco, he had harvested tobacco, he knew the tobacco industry. And so I'm a journalist on the floor of the convention. I mean, I not only have a great cartoon, but I need a story for the cartoon. I mean, no one knew this story, much less my opportunity to get a cartoon about it. And so I wrote a story on the floor. I worked for Scripps Howard News Service in the Washington Bureau. Wrote a story for the Scripps Howard Bureau, but we were we weren't a powerhouse at a convention. Conventions are really dominated by AP, by the New York Times, by the big three networks, and really there was little way to really get this story out. There was a very small fledgling publication at the convention that year called the Weekly Standard magazine that had just started that year, that was putting out a newsletter, and I took our story to them, and they got some of that information out. But it was very hard to get out, to get news out beyond the mainstream media filter. Today, that wouldn't happen. 15 years later, the landscape has dramatically changed. If Al Gore was to give that speech today, this wonderful mix of media that we have now, the networks would ignore that story, that element of Gore's past. You would have Fox News, you would have the Washington Examiner, you'd have the National Review Online, you'd have the Weekly Standard, you'd have the Washington Times, you would have all these other outlets that would be more than willing to get that information out. And that's important, because I think as we as Americans and Michiganders look ahead and try to wrestle with our problems, we need that information. Let me just illustrate that point with a slide. Currently, nationally, there's a major scientific story right now. Scientific scandal. It's the greatest scientific scandal we've had in a century. It's called ClimateGate, which is generally being ignored by the New York Times, by the big three networks, but is getting quite a bit of coverage in other media outlets. And for people who want to know about ClimateGate, they can find information about it. In Michigan, we just broke a story at the Michigan View. It has been known for some time, but unreported, in Michigan and Michigan media, that a filmmaker named Michael Moore, who fancies himself a speaker for the, who fancies himself a spokesman for the Occupy Wall Street movement and a spokesman for the 99% movement, owns a 10,000 square foot, $2 million summer home on one of the most exclusive lakes in northern Michigan, on Torch Lake. There it is right now, 99%er Michael Moore's summer home. And we just broke that story a couple weeks ago in the Michigan View.com. Again, an illustration of the new media and how the information is out there in ways never before. And let me I want to use that as a segue into Michigan in general and what Michigan means to this country. I'm not a native Michigander. I moved there 10 years ago, but I think Michigan is one of the four great news states, Detroit being at the center of Michigan, Detroit being one of the four great news cities in the United States. L.A., because we all watch the movies that come out of L.A., Washington, D.C., because it's our capital, New York, because we all have investments in Wall Street, and Detroit, because that's where our cars are made. And I think inherently all of us care, to some degree, what goes on in Detroit, both in the auto industry and in the state in general. So it's a fascinating news place, a place to be a newsman. And I wanted to talk about three things, sort of give you three examples of what's going on in Michigan that I think make it a bellwether for the rest of the country, looking down the pike here a little bit. Let's start with the auto industry. This is a front page from the Michigan View. One reason that Michigan is so influential in national politics is because of the auto industry. And it's not only an economic power, but it's a political power because it is the most complicated, the most involved consumer product that's made in this country. And in 2009, that auto industry, at least the GM and Chrysler ends of it, got bailed out. And that was widely unpopular in the rest of the country. It was very popular in Michigan for obvious reasons. But in reflecting on that, and I think this is going to be a big issue in the coming presidential campaign, in reflecting on that, there is not a Republican or a Democratic president, I would argue, who would not have bailed out the Detroit auto industry. I mean, if you look at the footprint of the auto industry in this country, GM alone has major facilities in every major state: California, Texas, Michigan, Ohio, Maryland. Go across the map. And I don't think there would be a president who, in the face of that company collapsing, who wouldn't have intervened in some way or another. Now, if you're a Republican, if you're George Bush, who actually gave GM the first infusion of cash, about $17 billion, I believe, in December of 2008, the prospect of so many suppliers, and these are Fortune 500 suppliers, forget GM, just the manufacturing tail of GM, the prospect of so many of those companies going bankrupt in an environment where credit had frozen, where the financial markets had frozen. I think Bush would have intervened. I think if Mitt Romney had been president, I think he would have intervened. They would have intervened in a different way, but the prospect of so many businesses going into bankruptcy would have been too much to ignore. Look at it from the perspective of a Democrat, from Barack Obama's perspective. The reason that he intervened is not so much that he cares about the auto industry itself, but because the United Auto Workers is a major contributor, a major backbone to the financing of the Democratic Party. So it was important for him not to allow GM to go into a proper Chapter 11 bankruptcy. But the real question is how did the auto industry get into this pickle in the first place? How was it that the auto industry got to this point in 2009? And it goes back to fundamentals. Its fundamentals were out of whack. If you looked at the job at the wage and benefit pay at GM, to use GM as an example, going into 2008, GM was paying $70 an hour to its line workers in wages and benefits. And compare that to its chief competitors, Toyota and Honda, which were paying $53 an hour in this country, in factories in this country, and compare that to the new Japanese, the Korean manufacturers, Kia and Hyundai, which were paying $42 an hour in wages and benefits. It was unsustainable. It was uncompetitive, and ultimately it led to a bankruptcy. The good news is, in post-bankruptcy, GM has righted that ship, and has made its wages much more competitive, at least with Toyota. And Honda is still not competitive with Korea, which should be a concern, since the Koreans are gaining market share faster than any other automaker in the country. But if you look at that lesson from GM, the labor overhead lesson, and look across the landscape in America today, every major institution, virtually every major institutional crisis we're having in this country right now, is because of union labor overhead. Look at the city of Detroit itself, which is about to go bankrupt because of unsustainable labor costs. Look at labor costs. Look at American Airlines. Look at the U.S. Postal Service. Look at school districts around this country. This is a huge issue in every state, and GM is a leader in how you tackle that problem. Lesson number two, and this small lesson here, and that not all cartoons are funny. Cartoons can be poignant. The two young men on a street in Detroit here, one says to the other, "What do you want to be if you grow up?" The city of Detroit in Michigan is the most dysfunctional city in the United States, but it is not alone in its core pathologies. Detroit is a lesson for the nation because it is an example of social breakdown. It is an example of what happens when society abandons its fundamental building block of family. Today, America does have a wealth gap, and that's not just because the rich are getting richer, but because America has developed a permanent underclass in places like Detroit, St. Louis, Baltimore, parts of New York City, even in rural regions in Appalachia, where I grew up in West Virginia. If you look at Detroit, for example, Detroit today has an 80% illegitimacy rate. 80%, that is 80% of children are born into a single-parent family. The adult male is virtually non-existent in the life of young children, and that's particularly important in the case of young males. I've got two of them that I've raised, and those of you in the room of young raised boys know that they're a more aggressive lot. They're a challenge, and they need role models. They need the tough hand of a father in the home. That father is non-existent in places like Appalachia and places like Detroit. And the result of that single family culture, that 80% of children who grow up without a dad, feeds every pathology in Detroit today. A 24% high school graduation rate, a 50% adult illiteracy rate, 30% of young males that don't graduate from school in Detroit wind up in jail, but that don't have a high school degree at some point in their life, 30% of young males wind up in jail. And all of that feeds a criminal culture that keeps Detroit perpetually in the top five in the country in criminal statistics, in murder, and in crime. One of my columnists at the Michigan View is a gentleman named Bill Johnson, who I think is the best urban columnist in America, and he writes about this frequently and its impact on other cities like Baltimore and New Orleans. And he says that whereas once Detroit was an assembly line for cars, today it is an assembly line for criminals. And if you look at the social data, and quite a bit of it's been done by Cornell University and Princeton University and Harvard, if you look at the social data, this lack of family structure has become a vicious generational cycle that is breeding a perpetual underclass in this country. And those studies and others, particularly by a gentleman named Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation, have concluded that the lack of a two-parent home is the number one indicator of poverty in the United States today. Lesson number three. I promised you a little good news, though, because for all of Detroit's troubles with its fundamentals, for all of Michigan's troubles, Michigan is also meeting those troubles head on, and is showing us how to turn things around, even in its lowest moments. Long before President Obama took office in 2009, for example, one of his closest political allies was Jennifer Granholm, who's a very, very similar politician to Obama. Very attractive, Harvard-trained, a lawyer, very ideologically strong, but with no executive experience. And when she came in to office, her blueprint for how to turn Michigan's economy around was exactly that of what Obama has done as President of the United States in the last three years. In 2006, our Governor Granholm introduced a massive stimulus bill that gave millions of dollars to public infrastructure, gave millions of dollars to green tech firms that she said were the future of Michigan manufacturing and that would lead the state out of its doldrums. And she addressed a $1.4 billion budget deficit with a 12% income tax hike. By the time she left office, 4 years later, the state unemployment rate had climbed from 7% to 11%. Many of the firms that the state had invested in, Fisher Coachworks, Rasco, Evergreen, had all gone bankrupt. And the state's bond rating, and the state had lost its AAA bond rating. All of this should sound familiar, because it was the blueprint that Barack Obama used when he went to Washington. But as a result of Granholm's experiment in Michigan, Michiganders got an election. They got a chance to address these issues last year in 2010. And what they did was they hired a businessman named Rick Snyder to be their governor. Rick Snyder campaigned as one tough nerd, which is wonderful for a cartoonist. I love it when politicians give me instant metaphors, so it's been easy for me to draw him. I draw him as a nerd in all our campaigns, and he proudly refers to himself as a nerd. He was an accountant. The guy is as dry as toast, most uninspiring public speaker I think I've ever heard from a politician. And he won the election last year in 2010, promising to run Michigan, to run Michigan's government like a business. Governor Snyder came in, he put in place business metrics, he simplified the tax code, he scaled back public subsidies, he challenged unions to pay their share of wage and benefits costs, and by May, he had a balanced budget. He had turned a $2 billion budget deficit into a balanced budget in less than half a year. And Snyder was just in our office the other day. We interviewed him at the Detroit News and Michigan View the other day. And And I said to him, I said, Governor, you know, normally when governor, at least for the last 4 years, when the governor has come into this office, the budget dominated the conversation. And we're not talking about the budget at all because it's balanced. It's not an issue. And I said, can you walk us through your budget? How did you manage to balance the budget in your first year in office? Was it because revenues are up, because the economy is picking up a little bit? Was it because of the you got union costs under control? And he just kind of looked at me quizzically, and he said, Henry, I've got to balance my budget. I'm the chief executive officer of this state. That's my job. And as simple as that answer was, it was awfully refreshing to hear that sort of common sense approach to government. It did not come without a lot of hollering. There were some venomous protests in the nation's capital, in Michigan's capital, over the last year against his cuts. There was an attempt to recall him as he went through the budget and tried to put it right. But in the end, the job got done. He did his job, as he rightly says. And most importantly for our state, this fall the rating agencies have upgraded Michigan's debt for the first time in years. So you see, folks, it can be done. All you got to do is concentrate on the fundamentals. Thank you very much. And
Henry, we've got a lot of questions, and they fall into four categories, one of which you didn't have time to get to, which is national politics, and I'm going to start with that. We have a student question. How do you feel about Newt Gingrich's recent lead in the Republican poll?
Well, I tell you, Newt Gingrich is one of the most fascinating politicians I've ever met. I when I was in Washington with Scripps, I was one of the first reporters who got to follow him for a day. This was back in 1994, after the so-called Republican Revolution. The Republicans had won back the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. And Newt Gingrich was the general that led that. He's a brilliant strategist. And it was interesting spending a day in his office. He's a stand-up desk guy. So you walk into his office and there are no desks because he does all of his business standing up. But he's also got one of the biggest egos of of anybody I've met, and Washington is full of big egos. But as you walked from his stand-up desk office into his conference room, he when he came in as the Speaker of the House, this is 1994, he had asked the Smithsonian if they could move their Tyrannosaurus Rex skull into his conference room. So when you walked into the conference room, about a quarter of the room was taken up by a T-Rex skull that was behind glass and sitting in a corner of the room. And it had its effect in intimidation. I say all that because Gingrich was a brilliant strategist, but obviously led one of the seminal Republican victories in the latter half of the 20th century. But that ego tends to get in his way. And ultimately, he left office, I think, because he relished too much the chance to go mano a mano on Bill Clinton. And I suspect in the campaign ahead, I think the reason Gingrich is the last man standing against Romney has a lot to do with luck. Rick Perry has not turned out to be the great Texas candidate that everybody anticipated. Herman Cain's had his problems. Everybody's been looking for an alternative to Mitt Romney, and Gingrich just happens to be the last man standing. But he's a brilliant spokesman for the party. But I think he lacks the organizational skills and the personal discipline. There's that ego. Lacks that personal discipline, I think, to defeat Mitt Romney.
I think you just answered the next question. What can be done to stop Gingrich and nominate Romney? I think what you said is Gingrich might stop himself.
Yeah. I mean, just go back in time a little bit. One of the politicians everybody thought would be a brilliant presidential candidate was Jack Kemp. Jack Kemp was a key player in the Reagan Revolution, a brilliant guy. I mean, he'd throw out 10 ideas an hour, and everyone thought he would be a wonderful presidential candidate. Jack Kemp really lacked discipline. I mean, you really got to be disciplined. Running for office is a business. It's a big business. And Kemp lacked that discipline, and I think that that may hurt Gingrich as well.
I'm going to shift gears and get into the personal side. There are quite a number of questions about you as a person, and one from a student.
I'm going to get my wife up here to
By the way, I should introduce one of his Princeton classmates and a terrific partner in life in many, many ways, Talbot Payne. Please stand up.
Go over on this side of it.
The question from a student is, what sparked your initial interest in politics and journalism, and why did you choose cartoons as a means of expressing the problems we face in America?
Well, it's a good question, and I spoke about, I grew up in a business family. I grew up in a father who was very civic-minded, and so both business and politics were discussed at the dinner table as I grew up, and my father was heavily involved in back in West Virginia in state and city politics. So I grew up in that conversation. Turned out I developed a skill of cartooning, and I went into journalism as a cartoonist, which is unusual. Usually it's the reverse. Cartoonists start out as writers, and then they over time they justify themselves as cartoonists. So I started as a cartoonist, but what happened to me was in this sort of a monolithic liberal press environment of the 80s and 90s, I found there were so many stories in Washington, D.C. that I would love to cartoon about that but weren't being reported. I mean, you can't write a cut line. There's no cut line on that cartoon, but you can't write a cut line without a headline. People need to know a subject before you can tell a joke about it. And so I actually got into reporting heavily and from there have become an editor and other things as well.
Has your career provided you with another student question? Has your career provided you with an opportunity to travel around the country? You can just say yes, because we have a lot of questions.
Yeah, well, and it's a great country. I mean, this is such a fabulous country, and it's so different in many ways from the Northeast to the West. Both in culture and in its visual beauty, that I've made a point in my life to travel quite a bit.
And I've got a couple of more personal questions here, but I'm not going to give them all. But one more student, I'd like to get the student questions in. What, in your opinion, has been your greatest accomplishment?
Well, there's a saying in cartooning that you're only as good as your latest cartoon, and I believe that, and I suspect I would answer the question and say the Michigan View I'm very proud of. We launched just a little over a year ago, bringing together the best writers in Michigan and taking advantage of the 24/7 nature of the internet. It's been a fabulous experience in working and developing the new media. So today I would say my cartoon that appeared in the newspaper and the Michigan View.
Thank you. Now we'll switch to the auto industry. There's a phenomenal number of questions on that. First one that I thought would be kind of fun: would you buy a Chevy Volt today? I'm sorry, Bill Hoagland, if you're here. Bill Wood.
The Chevy Volt is really a fascinating product in a lot of ways. It's not the biggest problem I have with the Volt up front is that it's a $40,000 vehicle. And one reason that Washington, that Barack Obama was so interested in bailing out GM was not just the UAW, but he's entranced by electric cars, and so he was really determined that the Chevy Volt get built. But the fact that the Volt is a $40,000 car means that its demographic, its sales demographic, is $200,000 and above, And Washington gives a $7,500 tax break to people who buy the Chevy Volt. I have a problem with giving $7,500 tax breaks to people who make over $200,000 a year. That said, the Volt, what it represents for GM is a new technology. And for any product manufacturer, whether you're Apple or whether you're GM, a halo product goes a long way. And the fact that GM is making one of an advanced new technology in the Chevy Volt, I think, is bringing customers into their dealerships. I think they get a lot of press from people like me, which is good. But let me finish the question with this, and this is a testament to how good cars are in general and how good one company, GM's, products are. The Chevy Volt is built on the Chevy Cruze platform. The Chevy Cruze is the entry-level vehicle that GM makes. It's a $17,000 car that is capable of getting nearly 40 miles to a gallon. And in fact, if you do the math on buying a $40,000 Chevy Volt and its gas mileage and buying a $17,000 Chevy Cruze and its gas mileage, it is a better buy to buy the Chevy Cruze and the Chevy Volt. So
you can see that Henry's pretty well versed on a lot of things. I have a lot of questions about Detroit that also involve the auto industry, and let me try to combine them. One is from a student: what do you believe can be done to reverse the effects of the mass exodus from Detroit? Who is going to bail out Detroit? Will increasing productivity at the auto industry save it with more robots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And how is Mayor Bing doing? So if you put all that together, what do you think?
Well, I'm bullish on Michigan. I think I come from West Virginia, and a lot of folks in Michigan, a lot of friends of mine in Michigan, they cry in their soup and they say, oh, woe is us, Michigan's the next West Virginia, it's the next Alabama. And I tell them, no, it's not. States like West Virginia pull stuff out of the ground, and in West Virginia's case, coal. And as a result, you sort of develop a working class and a hyper management class. What's wonderful about Michigan in producing a product like the automobile is it creates this enormous middle class, this enormous entrepreneurial middle class, and that gives you universities because you got to train all those engineers. The entrepreneurs come rich, and they put money back in the universities. You got universities in Michigan like Michigan State, University of Michigan, Wayne State, Norwood University, on and on and on, that are constantly training good talent. Now, these days, a lot of that talent is going out of state as the state works through its problems. But that infrastructure is there. It's also a beautiful state, being nestled in the middle of the Great Lakes. So I think Michigan's potential is enormous. In terms of Detroit, though, I'm a glass half full guy, as I think you can tell. But I think Detroit and cities like it, New Orleans, Baltimore, et cetera, are a very difficult question. Detroit has lost its middle class because of its crime because of its crime rate and because the schools are so poor, primarily for the reason I enunciated, this the collapse of the family in the lower income strata of Michigan. The middle class is gone. It has left Detroit. And I don't know how you get the middle class back, and I don't know how you turn around a cultural breakdown as serious as what has happened to the family in Detroit. And one analogy there. I went to school at Princeton in the shadow of New York in the 80s. New York was a basket case in the 1980s. As students, we didn't go to New York. You didn't go to Times Square. You didn't go to 42nd Street in the 1980s. Because the crime was so bad. It was that dangerous a place. But New York City never lost its middle class. And at some point, that middle class said enough. And it brought in Mayor Rudy Giuliani, cleaned up the city. And today, New York's a phenomenal place. But without that middle class to make that political change, I think it's going to be very tough for Detroit.
I want to introduce the editor of the Daily News here in town, Phil Lewis. Phil, Stan. And I do that because the Daily News runs Henry's cartoons pretty regularly, so watch for them, and I want to give them an ad. Still loyal. There are a lot of questions about the media, and let me start with a couple that I think you'll enjoy, and then we'll have to wrap it up. Unfortunately, we won't get to all the questions. The media seems to be more opinion and less fact. Your comment.
I don't think that's true. I've grown up in newspapers, and I think because newspapers have been around so long, people are used to the product. But in a newspaper, you have a news section, and you have an opinion section. And we try to keep those departments separately. But for people who go into a newspaper, you can find a lot of opinion, not just in the editorial page, but also in the sports section. And in the cultural arts section and movie reviews and whatnot. So I think there's always in journalism, particularly in newspapers, which is the oldest form of media, I think we're used to where opinion is. And I think in this new environment, this Wild West environment of the internet and URLs that you can click to all over the place, and cable news, where to use Fox, for example, where they're all opinion at night, but they do their hard news during the day and at 6 p.m. and the nightly news. I think there's hard news and there's opinion news and it has its place. I think we're just still kind of working out our daily schedules and where we can find it.
A related question, why is the media so liberal and biased? You understand the mood of the crowd, I mean.
Well, and I, being conservative-minded, I've always been a minority in the business. It is. It's a very liberal business, both in the newsroom and at the corporate level. Not this corporate guy, but the New York Times, Gannett are very liberal corporations to work for. And I the term elites is thrown around. A lot, but I think that's an accurate cultural classification. I think the so-called elite, the so-called arts end of the economic spectrum, tends to be more liberal. Whether it's the church, whether it's academia, whether it's journalism, tends to be more anti-establishment, and the business community tends to be more conservative. I will say this, though, and looking at it on paper, I don't quite understand why journalism is as liberal as it is, because we are protected by the First Amendment. I mean, the First Amendment is one of the most anti-government sections of the U.S. Constitution. The First Amendment is there to keep government out of our business. And boy, wouldn't most businesses that we cover in journalism like that kind of luxury to have government off its back and regulation? And I think to some degree we journalists are spoiled by the First Amendment. We don't realize what it is to have government down your throat all the time, the way a lot of businesses in this country do. So I think because of the First Amendment, we should be more conservative than we are.
Well, it's the afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. That philosophy, I think, explains it too. And I'm going to ask one last very controversial question. Because you are a cartoonist, we have to have one cartoonist question. What was your reaction to the, I think it was Dutch cartoon that portrayed Muslims in a very negative light that led to riots and murders and so on and so forth?
Well, again, to go back to the First Amendment. I mean, we are awfully fortunate in this country to have freedom of speech, and we take it too much for granted. Back in the late 80s, there was a cartoonist in Palestine who drew cartoons that were critical of Yasser Arafat. He was driven out of the Middle East to London, and PLO operatives hunted him down in London and killed him on the streets of London because he continued to draw negative cartoons about Arafat. Same with these Norwegian cartoonists, who, if you look at the cartoons, some of them are pretty good, but they violate this extreme this extreme end of Islam that we've seen hit the trade towers, it violates their religious commandment. And as a result, these cartoonists are all in hiding today. What a tragedy! So I thank God for the for this country and the laws that we have.
Let's give him a big hand. Thank you very much.
Alan's leaving, but first I want to.